This Black Friday, get 6 months free when you move your WordPress sites to Kinsta. Enjoy faster load times, no stress when traffic spikes, and hosting you can actually count on. We're G2's number one rated host for WordPress. For a reason. Visit kinsta.com/BF. That's KINSTA.com/BF. Don't miss out. Offer ends December 2nd.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and we're here to discuss the defense from that awful game against the Chiefs. Truly one of the awful days or day and a half we've had in Baltimore football in a very long time in terms of both the loss to the Chiefs, the injuries suffered in the game, and subsequently the news about Nnamdi Madubuike. Joining us here to talk about all that is Nick Mehta. Nick, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Ken. Despite how the Ravens have played lately, you know, it's tough to see a team struggle like this, but the GM and the armchair GM, the armchair coach in me always likes to look at this as a way to learn more, discover more about younger players and kind of test myself to see if I can come up with any ideas for what a team does when they're faced in this with this kind of situation.
Yeah, well, critical loss. Of course, let's start with the news about Nnamdi Madubuike, though, today. Harbaugh used a syntax that I have unfortunately heard before, saying he's out for the season. And there was a follow-up question or question that went with that. Is this career threatening? And he said, I'm going to let him address that with you, kind of thing. So respecting all that's going on, look for second opinions, yada, yada. But I've heard him use that syntax before, not necessarily in the case of an injury, although he might have done it with Zach Gore. I just can't recall. But he did it with Steve Smith one time when Steve Smith was about to retire. He said, Steve Smith won't be out there. And I forget what it was for practice or something. And he said, but I'll let him talk to you about that kind of thing. And that syntax usually means the road is ended.
Yeah, it's you know, neck injuries. I think everyone's alarm bells were ringing when it was first, you know, revealed that he was dealing with a neck injury, especially with the complete lack of clarity about what was going on. And even not placing him on injured reserve before the Lions game was a very clear sign that this is going to be far more than four games. There was no way that he was going to have a short absence and be ready to go again. And you know, I it's unfortunate. I don't like speculating about the future of someone's career. Obviously, there are contract and long-term team building issues that come into play. But I do think that one other thing that, you know, Harbaugh does kind of express when he gives players room to talk about their own injuries is that he wants them to talk to the media about what is going on. I mean, he's typically pretty hesitant to talk about anything related to injuries in the first place. I remember when Lamar got hurt, one of the injuries a couple years ago, we didn't know what it exactly was until after the season. They kept it under wraps that tight. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's always hope. I noticed that Bilal Nichols, the Cardinals defensive tackle, had a season-ending neck injury last year, and there were concerns about his long-term career, and he returned to practice today. So I think, you know, it's hard to have hope about the Ravens defense right now, about the season in general. But I do think it's easier to have hope about an individual player who you really respect and admire and just hope that he's able to suit up again.
Yeah, I hope he's able to hope that he makes the right decision about for himself and for his family and for sure, his future in terms of what's going on. Obviously, you know, without Nnamdi and without a bunch of other players, the injured defense really sagged in this loss. They had a lack of ability to generate push up front that was very noticeable. They just could not get any penetration to set up any runs for losses, which meant that the Chiefs were continually running ahead of the sticks in this game. A lot of third and short, and you know, up to about 4 or 5 yards. Not too much longer than that. They weren't even that great on third down, which we'll get to in a minute. But they were always in pretty damn good position relative to the sticks. They had a tremendous lack of pass rush from the interior. That they we'll get to some of that later. But they're the three edge rushers of note shared with the team lead with contributions to two pressure events. And the Chiefs threw the ball, what, 35, 36 times, whatever it was for the game.
Yeah. And I think obviously we just talked about Madubuike. Travis Jones also dealing with a knee injury. Broderick Washington, who, look, has not been very good this season by any metric, but is still a veteran player on this defense and is, you know, it'll be interesting to see over the next few weeks, especially in terms of Washington, who's probably not going to be a Raven after this year with his contract and has not been a successful extension in general. I'm kind of curious to see if, you know, more time from Jenkins or Peebles might have a slight upgrade in Washington's play. Now, obviously, the loss of Madubuike and Jones is, you know, it's going to be impossible to offset that. But Washington was playing so poorly that I genuinely think it could be a case of addition by subtraction. And maybe if he was, you know, if the play was impacted by the injury, he can get back to a higher level when he comes back. But that was one that I noted was, you know, losing Jones and Madubuike is the big losses. Washington, you lose depth. But I did feel like John Jenkins, for example, played better on Sunday than Washington has all year.
I could maybe agree with that. I don't think Jenkins was perfect by any stretch, but, you know, he made some tackles. I think we're going to get into that a little later, because the topic we're going to try and cover on this show in some depth is how the Ravens are going to go about fielding a defense at all. And they did not have the horses necessary to play a football game on Sunday. It's just that simple. They did not have the players necessary to field a team, and they had to make some really significant concessions in terms of packages to set up for this. I mean, just I'll spoil a plot here a little bit. They used a package they have never used in 30 years of their history, never used on a play that included zero defensive linemen on it in this game. So they did not have the horses, particularly on the defensive line, to play this football game. They were playing on a short week. I'm actually a lot less bothered about the defensive performance in this game than I think a lot of people are. A lot of people are like, fire Zach Gore. And I'm like, you know, for what? There's literally no one out there. There's literally no one that remains out there.
I guess what frustrated me was the amount of times, and this was earlier in the game before Marlon and Roquan went down, because I do agree coming into the game already way shorthanded. Once Marlon, Roquan, and then Nate Wiggins gone down, it was over. That they didn't have the bodies. But even before the injuries started piling up, I was pretty disappointed in the way that the Chiefs used similar plays to what we've seen from this offense in the past, and the Ravens just did not seem ready for it. One example, if I can point out a specific one, is that fake screen to slant. I think it was to Hollywood Brown early in the game. The Chiefs run a fake screen with a receiver faking a block and releasing into a route all the time. They've killed the Ravens with that play. And they pulled it out again. And as someone who didn't play football at all in his life, seeing that from the snap and not having none of the Ravens see it from the snap was a little frustrating, when it's like, I know that play. You should know that play. And I felt like that happened more times than I'm comfortable with. Now, again, I know all the changes has an impact on that, but it did feel that the defense was less prepared than they should be against an opponent that should be very familiar by now.
Well, you know, they can be as familiar as you want. You trot out, you know, players of the quality they did on the defensive line, and they're not backups, you know, that you're relying on for 10 to 12 snaps a game. They're all of a sudden playing 45 snaps. Then you have a big problem. And that was the case. They didn't have any plus defensive linemen in the game. It was kind of an interesting story to have Okoye on the field. John Jenkins has been maybe a little better than expected in terms of what he's brought. He did, you know, his last 2 years, you could argue, have been his best two. They certainly been his highest snap count years out in Las Vegas. So it's the actual snap total this game was not so far out of line from what he played in Las Vegas. But, you know, there's other things going on. They were out snapped very badly again, 70 to 53 in this game. They've now lost snap count by an average of 19.0 per game. They're at minus 76 in terms of offensive snaps through four games. That's just ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Now, part of that is that the defense isn't really equipped to stop fourth down plays. In the last 2 weeks, I think they've given up 7 for 7 on fourth down. Yep. So 3 for 3 against the Lions, 4 for 4 against the Chiefs. That'll extend a lot of drives. That's the 2019 Ravens formula for staying on the field for a ton of snaps. But another part of it is the offense is not doing their job in terms of moving the football and sustaining drives. And they just had a bad effort in terms of getting that done. So work is needed on both sides. The defense needs to play better. They need to be a little bit more efficient getting the other team off the field on four downs, not just on three, which they did pretty well. they can't keep up these high snap count contests with the defense that they have. They already have, you know, are down to their backups, and whoever's backing up them is at even a lower level. You know, Josh Tupou, they're bringing off the practice squad, and Okoye for that matter, playing more snaps. The guys that are now in at cornerback, I think there are people who would, kind of laugh at how Marlon Humphrey has played this year, and then, not be too concerned about Keon Martin coming in or TJ Tampa coming in to replace Wiggins. It's ridiculous, frankly. I mean, but those guys are significantly better football players, and this is an unbelievable shame that this is the way the season is playing out.
Yeah, I mean, that's like very different from the Broderick Washington example I used earlier in terms of the replacement. You know, with Marlon and Roquan, you're losing not just their talent, but their roles and their familiarity in the defense, and so much of what you do on defense is planned around, built around what you know certain players can do, especially at the off-ball linebacker and nickel positions. And so, the idea that, neither of them are having a great start to the season, but that really does not mean that whoever you put in for them is going to play better, especially if the issues are, as schematic as some people are saying. I agree with you that the commentary can be inconsistent and fit to whatever someone's end desire is.
Yeah, there's a lot of that going on. I mean, obviously there's a large, occasionally silent group of people. I think it's still a minority, but it's a growing plurality of people who want to get rid of John Harbaugh. And it might be approaching 50% at this point. I don't know. I still get the sense it's a little lower than that, but the people who are pro Harbaugh people aren't talking up right now. They're not saying, wait a minute, just pump the brakes for a second. Look at what's happened. Look at what's going on. Are you really blaming this on Harbaugh? I understand the risks are very great right now. And we've seen at the times where Harbaugh has been in jeopardy as a coach, it's been after big injury riddled years. The Ravens have now, I've been through five of these I've been through more than that, but because 1996 was a year decimated by injuries on the defensive line for starters. But in the last 21 years, the Ravens have now had five such years, which have just been absolutely washed away by injuries. And if people need a reminder, it's 2005, 2007. That's the Street of Dying Men, the secondary of dying men year for the Ravens. Just everybody got hurt in the secondary, and they were down to nobody at the end of the year. 2015, which was a disastrous year that included Joe Flacco's injury, Terrell Suggs injured in the first game, etc. A whole bunch of other injuries. 2021, when Lamar was hurt for the first time. Some would argue 2022. I don't think that's unreasonable. The Ravens lost Lamar, which is always the most serious injury you can have, and they barely snuck into the playoffs and then lost in the first round. So in a lot of ways, that year was covered, but I didn't count it in the five. And then I think you have to look at 2025 and say the year is probably done right now. It's not a year, let me put it this way, it's probably done as far as winning the Super Bowl goes. Okay, they might very well make the playoffs. By the way, I did just do a little bit of analysis out there looking at a site called Odds Checker, which aggregates the various lines for various books that are available. The Ravens, if you believe this, and don't blame me if you don't, I'll tell you how to deal with it, okay? But the Ravens still have a 61% chance to win the AFC North according to the best price available on wagering markets. Now, I don't shoot the messenger. I'm just reporting how the public is betting on this. And by the way, there's only 2% aggregate VIG in that line. So it's the best price at various places. Some place has the best price on the Ravens. Some other place has the best price on the Bengals, et cetera, et cetera. But if you wanted to synthetically bet that the Ravens will not win the North, you can easily do it. And I would explain happily, probably on another pod, exactly how to do that. But you have to just make three bets, make a bet on the Steelers, a bet on the Browns, and a bet on the Bengals. And you can synthesize the not the Ravens bet and make almost that entire amount. You probably have to accept that it would be about a 59.5% chance that they would win the AFC North or less to make that bet worthwhile just on a dollars basis. So I'm you know, I'm frustrated as hell, but you know, the general public still seems to believe that the Ravens have a chance to win this.
Yeah, I think, you know, a couple of things. I think one is that wagering markets are removed, for better and for worse, from the kind of emotionality and analysis paralysis that comes when you're so close to a team. That can happen when, you know, we're so close to the team. We always see is the Ravens falling apart. But the rest of the division is still the Browns, the Drake Browning Bengals, who just got smacked by the Broncos, and the Steelers, who, you know, they're the Steelers one way or the other. So I guess that, looking at the whole division, you could wrap your head around that number, right? But looking at just the Ravens, it's like, what are you talking about? So I think it's also a measure of how the Ravens are viewed nationally relative to locally. I think a lot of teams still are, a lot of, you know, people, obviously odds makers, but national media experts, they are just now coming around to the idea that the Ravens might be in big trouble. But I would say locally, the alarm bells have been ringing, you could argue, as far back as week one, when Matabike went down, and then certainly after the loss to the Lions.
Yeah, I'm the markets are what the markets are, but I will say this, the line that's out there is not count of idiots weighted, it's dollar weighted. So it's overweighted for money put down by sharps who see inefficiencies in the line. So just because 75% of the people think the Ravens are done, if the sharps don't believe it, they'll wager enough money on that to overcome those, you know, the money bet by others. So, you know, it's a dollar weighted line. It's markets, the larger the market gets, the more efficient it is. And gambling markets in the United States on football are freaking enormous. Mm-hmm. So it's really a case of, I have a hard time. Yeah, I wouldn't take a position on either side of this, by the way. I think I'd say, but I'm not one to say either. The 61% still looks too high to me, but I wouldn't take a position on either side.
Yeah, it looks too high, but it's still, it looks too high, but it's on the high end of believable for me. And I guess that's why I would stay away entirely.
All right. Now let's get into the topic that we really want to spend some time on tonight, which is how the Ravens are even going to field a team the rest of the year, because a lot of things have to be done. I mean, for starters, the defensive line, if it plays at this level, I'm not sure they'll make it through the season with the players they have. I think they'd have more injury problems if they can't reduce snap count and do some things to shorten football games. But let's go one unit at a time in terms of just how they can find the personnel they need here. And I think at least my position on this is going to be probably the Ravens should make no high cost moves to improve the team at this point. Where are you on that, Nick?
Again, I always try to be an optimistic guy, but it's really hard to endorse sinking even a day two pick into a trade for a player, because you have to think about, what are you actually going to get for a day two pick? When Matabike went down, right, the names that started getting thrown around, I think the big one, to use it as an example, was Dexter Lawrence, right, the Giants defensive tackle. And the problem with that is you're replacing Matabike with him instead of adding him to Matabike and heightening the ceiling of the team. You're only trying to make up for what you've lost. And with all the other losses and the other issues that the team has showed to start the season, I can't be convinced that trading for Dexter Lawrence is going to be the difference for this team. Now, everyone else being, you know, the rest of the roster being mostly healthy, Matabike and Jones both being healthy and inserting a third dangerous interior rusher next to him, then we can talk about pushing in the chips, but that's just not in the cards this year.
So I guess I would look at it a little differently. And this is, I'll call this the, what Bill James once called the early Steinbrenner philosophy of free agent acquisition, is identify the best player out there, regardless of your needs, go get him. And oftentimes you'll find out the puzzle pieces can be moved around such that you're replacing a very bad player that you have. And so, you know, one of Steinbrenner's successful early free agent acquisitions was Winfield. And, you know, that worked out for a number of years because they had really identified the best player. Reggie Jackson before that, if you want to talk about, you know, another free agent acquisition. But anyway, I think if you acquire Dexter Lawrence, the guy you're knocking off the roster from Dexter Lawrence, the guy who's you're taking snaps away from, is a very bad player right now. So I think you get actually more gain right now from Dexter Lawrence. You don't get, I think, what you're referring to, which is kind of like a compounded gain of having two great players together the way the Ravens did with Jones and Matabike.
Yes. And I think, I guess the thing is, if I were to go after a trade this year, I would want to look for someone with a contract that doesn't expire at the end of this year. Obviously that's probably the big thing. And to your point, I think that it does allow the Ravens to say, well, not that we're giving up on the year, because they'll never say that, but okay, instead of going to try to shore up our team wherever we need it the most, how about I just go shopping with a second or third round pick for whatever best player is out there that I can keep for multiple years? The thing is that that's just not the Eric DaCosta thing to do.
I mean, I can't treat a second or third round pick like it's a freaking party favor, because it's not. It's critical to the franchise. I mean, third round pick is what they used to get Travis Jones originally. Right. A second round pick is what they used to get Nnamdi Matabike originally. So right. a day two pick, to me, it would be out of the question to trade one of those for this team. It'd be absolutely out of the question. It's much too high a percentage of total draft capital for next year. I'm certainly not going to trade a one under virtually any circumstance. Let's keep going on the defensive line here in terms of the players they have here. They have John Jenkins, who played 44 snaps in this one. He played okay. I thought for what he was, he's pretty good, but he doesn't command double teams. He's not Travis Jones. They have Brent Urban playing 37 snaps. He basically was out there as a starter in this game. Brent's a great guy and a good space denier in the run game. Still had a pretty decent year last year for the Ravens. The Ravens had too much talent to keep him this year. They didn't even offer him a camp invite, and then they brought him in at the end because they wanted to have an extra lineman available. And boy, that's been very fortunate. Josh Tupou, 30 snaps in this game. He didn't generate a pressure. The biggest stat I've got on him for the game was that the Chiefs threw for 10.3 yards per pass when he was in there. And that was not a insignificant number of total pass snaps he was in there for. So, you're getting a replacement level player with Tupou. He's a professional, but he's a replacement level player. CJ Okoye is the big story. He's a guy who actually has a little bit of upside. Still, I think he's only 20. I think he might still only be 24 years old. This is his third year where he's been basically a practice squad player and just got his first NFL action. He had two defensive wins among three solo tackles. He did have a cleanup quarterback hit. It was well after 3 seconds, so it's not an initiated pressure as I would score it. And then they had Aeneas Peebles, who was an interesting one that almost deserves a separate discussion of himself, his own, because they don't want him out there for any snap except as a situational pass rusher, and they've made it very clear so far this season.
Yeah, and that was kind of always going to be the case with Peebles, certainly as a rookie and potentially in the long term, given just his size and his frame. I guess going through that list with you, John Jenkins, I have said this since training camp, since watching his Raiders film last year. He is a fine, if not decent level, backup nose tackle. He's not a high level starting nose tackle, but he's a pretty good backup nose tackle when you think about the size requirements and the technical requirements, the knowledge required to play that position. And I remember, thinking that during training camp and hoping that I wouldn't have to come back to that at all. But, he did fine. I don't mean to damn him with faint praise, because I do think, stepping into a big role against the Chiefs interior offensive line is nothing to be sneezed at. He just doesn't make impact plays. He is more of a replacement level player. I felt like Tupou was just not like bad, actively bad.
Not that good.
as much respect as I have for I believe a former undrafted guy who's carved out a niche, carved out a spot in this league. The inability for a guy that size to move offensive linemen even a little bit it's just not going to play. And I think one part of this game that was important to me was evaluating Tupou and Okoye because of the long-term needs of this defensive line and figuring out, as we're doing today, who is it going to be that fills these gaps? And Tupou, to me, the way he played, I'm more inclined to give, if they need to elevate another, right? I'm more inclined to give Taven Bryan a chance from the practice squad, because Tupou didn't show me anything that's worth repeating. Okoye, I thought was fine. He is still, you know, getting comfortable on the football field, and that Chiefs offense can be a bear to deal with. Again, the tough matchup with their interior line. But, you know, given that, I thought he acquitted himself well. You know, I'm grading on a curve here, right? We're not comparing him to Matabike or Jones. You know, I'm grading on the curve of what I was expecting, and I was satisfied. I wasn't blown away. But I did see a player who I think can be a defensive lineman. Obviously not a starter right away, but I think he can grow into a rotational defensive lineman in the NFL based on what I saw. And Peebles, of course, that's, like I said, that's going to be the issue. And, you know, unfortunately, the makeup of this team now is only going to make it harder and harder for him to get snaps, because they're going to get pushed into so many second and medium, third and short situations with the weakened defensive line and Roquan Smith out.
Yeah, I think you summarized it very well there. I don't think the team needs to have three nose tackles at once. And yet I don't think Taven Bryan is the answer either, because he's like Peebles. He's a smallish 3/5 tech, a penetrating guy. And he's had a little pass rush juice in his career. He's got about 14 sacks in his NFL career, which is not nothing. He's been in the league for quite a long time. Was originally a first round draft pick. He could be a guy that could give you a little something. I just think there's too much overlap between him and Peebles. I think they need bodies right now that can be out there. But if they're going to do that, then they need to commit to a lot of 1-3 jumbos. So they need to get Jenkins and Tupou, or Jenkins and Okoye, in together a lot, and really try and handcuff the opposing interior lines and try very hard to scheme off that with additional penetrators, possibly from level two, possibly exploiting the B gap from the slot, that sort of thing. They need to do something that will be probably compromising in its own right to take advantage of the fact that they have large guys who aren't particularly good. And unfortunately, that's where I see these guys. I'm not going to grade them on a curve. They're all several notches below Jones in terms of what they provide. None of them is a double team commander. They can, you know, if you've got four guys to block and one of them is John Jenkins, you might say, oh, okay, we'll double John among these guys, because, you know, none of them are particularly huge threats. But, you know, none of them are guys they want in on pass rush downs. And they showed that in this game by the fact that they did all kinds of things to use multiple outside linebacker packages, and even to the point where they replaced outside linebackers with inside linebackers, specifically with Trenton Simpson. Mm-hmm. So, boy, the Ravens went a long way to avoid having these guys on the field on third down.
Yeah, and again, it's just so, you know, you talk about how the injuries affect the defense, and I know fans don't like injuries being an excuse, especially when they do have some valid concerns about the team, regardless of the injuries. But it's hard, you know, even as we're talking about it, and this is why I love talking with you, Ken, you think about all the extra ways this impacts everything. Injuries impact everything else.
Yeah.
The Ravens' entire defensive philosophy is built around, having light person, nickel personnel that's good at stopping the run, so you can get into obvious passing situations. And, you know, the injuries to the defensive line alone make that very, very difficult to accomplish with nickel personnel the way they like to, not to mention losing Marlon Humphrey in the slot and Roquan Smith at linebacker, two of the players who made that strategy successful. So then if you pivot to another strategy, I know you know all of this, but if you pivot to another strategy, then you have to figure out the roles for how that changes everywhere else.
Yep.
It's a very, very delicate balance across your whole defense. And you know, just moving, swapping in and out defensive tackles is not, you know, how you get through this. You have to make the schematic adjustments to make up for your injuries up front, and then make adjustments everywhere else, not to mention all the injuries everywhere else, to then align with whatever new philosophy you have, whatever new aim you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah. So, it manifests itself in so many ways. It ripples the poor defensive line play, the overmatchedness of the interior defenders ripples through so many other things in terms of if they don't need a double team, then you have a whole bunch of other players who are also disadvantaged. Then you have to try and see if you want to get after a quarterback with the blitz. And when you do that against Mahomes, you are playing with fire. He gets rid of the ball so quickly. We'll get to some of the data on that later in, in either this show or the next one to talk about how much he got rid of the ball quickly in this game. The Ravens actually generated a little bit of pressure in this game. I'm not saying to say it was a lot, but they actually didn't give up a whole bunch of ATS opportunities to Mahomes. It was mostly a case of he got the ball out quickly and was very effective reading the defense right away and figuring out what they were trying to do.
Yeah, and the idea that there was going to be any interior pressure against this Chiefs O-line without Jones or Madubuike, much less both of them, was just not going to happen. It's just so tough to walk into a game and know that certain things you're just not going to be able to accomplish, and having to adjust for that on the fly. I know it sounds like I'm making excuses for Zach Orr and by extension John Harbaugh. I just think that the injuries and coaching end up being kind of two separate conversations, and far too often they get wrapped up in another. To me right now, it's the injuries is a week-to-week thing. The coaching is a long-term thing. Anyone who thinks that the Ravens are going to fire John Harbaugh this season, I don't know how long they've been following
during the season. It could happen in the offseason potentially, but yeah.
And to me, that's the time to talk about it more personally, because I'm more interested in, you know, what we're talking about today, which is how the injuries have a way of spreading across the defense. And as I mentioned at the beginning of this statement, you go into a game knowing you're not going to get interior pressure on Patrick Mahomes. And that's just something you have to admit and figure out how to scheme around. And there's no really easy way to do that. Especially for a guy like Mahomes, who is comfortable just sitting there in the pocket. A lot of quarterbacks, when they sit in the pocket for a while, they get happy feet. They start to dance around, they drift back, they take off. But Mahomes is just really comfortable and confident when he gets a lot of time back there. He actually doesn't scramble or extend plays unless he really has to. And it allows him to just stay in the pocket and find guys downfield eventually. So,
all right. So the defensive line, just to put a bow on this, Travis Jones will be returning at some point. We certainly hope. He practiced last Friday. I think it's possible that he returned as early as this week against the Texans. If he did, the defensive line would benefit significantly from that. No doubt he'd take a huge snap share, and the Ravens would again have a potent third down combination, presumably with Peebles and Jones together, which I think is the pairing we'd see for the rest of the year. And hopefully they'd be able to get the third down. But let's move on to the outside linebackers. The group generated just 5 pressures in aggregate. Now, 1.5 pressures for each of Oweh and Green. And Tavius Robinson, who had a pass defense at the line of scrimmage, which is a big play, and then the only sack, played pretty well, I thought, as well. Going through those guys, the big guy who's on the roster, who the Ravens have absolutely no role for, is David Ajabo. He played 6 snaps in his first game back, even though there were only 3 other inside linebackers. So he plays 6 snaps, and Mike Green, the rookie, plays 52. Okay, now there isn't any problem with that based on relative talent. There's all the problem in the world based on how much a rookie is ready to play NFL football on an extended snap basis.
Yeah, and I guess going back to, you know, you mentioned Green as a rookie. You know, they've been looking for him to make a splash, right? First round talent, and just hasn't had the opportunity or hasn't been able to convert on the opportunities to. I thought there were a number of snaps against Mahomes where he got a good jump, and Mahomes just got the ball out too quick. I think Green, probably more than anyone else on the Ravens defense, was the one who was maybe closest to making plays and wasn't able to as a result of that. Ajabo, look, this has been the case. This is why Ajabo was going to be waived during roster cutdowns if Adisa Isaac hadn't gotten injured. Right. Right. We all could read that writing on the wall. You know, if I were the Ravens, I would have waived Ajabo anyway and looked for someone else, because you know what you're getting, or better yet, what you're not getting out of David Ajabo at this point. And knowing that your edge group is, you know, behind Oweh and Van Noy, obviously Robinson is a very solid 3. I'm a big fan of his, but not knowing really what you're going to get out of Green Isaac, sticking with Ajabo as the extra man, to me, was just a mistake.
It didn't make a lot of sense to me either. Now, I'm going to take you back to a point in camp, and this is one of the things I did not really like communication-wise, because I never know if he might be talking about me is always one of the issues. But I knew I hadn't used certain words. There's probably other people he's talking about. But John Harbaugh actually gave us a lecture about not putting down David Ajabo at one point during camp. You were there for that?
Yeah.
Okay. And he basically said there's people in this circle who who are criticizing David Ojabo. The guy does nothing to do but come to work, work hard, you know, blah, 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 blah. Well, I mean, the Ravens have laid bare exactly what David Ojabo means to them these last 2 weeks. He's not on the field. This week, the Ravens allowed 7.9 yards per carry when he's on the field and 11.2 yards per pass. And in both categories, that was the highest figure for any Ravens defender.
Okay. Well, and the other thing that, you know, again, the word Harbaugh is always a triggering one, but the other thing I have an issue with that whole thing is David Ojabo hasn't played good football since he's been in the NFL. I don't think anyone is writing articles about David Ojabo refuses to work hard and that's why he's a bad. That's not what anyone in the world is saying. Everyone is doing what you and I do all the time, which is we look at the film, we look at the numbers, and we make assessments. And the universal assessment on David Ojabo is that he has not been a good football player in the National Football League. And I feel for him. I do. He was projected to be a first-round pick, and he tore his Achilles. The Ravens kind of bailed him out by drafting him in the second round, which, you know, felt like a mistake at the time and has rippled into one of the bigger mistakes of Eric DaCosta's drafting tenure. And has dealt with injuries since then. I feel for him, but that does not make him a better player. It just does not. And that does not change anyone's responsibility or anyone's, you know, responsibility or desire to evaluate him does not change by the fact he was injured and he's a hard worker. It doesn't change anything.
Right. It doesn't change it. And it's, yeah, it's one of the communication things that I would point to and say, this is something I didn't like in something that John Harbaugh said. And he was probably going after some member of the media there who had basically called David Ojabo a bust and probably used the B word, you know, in an article without really providing the correct support. I mean, I don't think a lot of people would accuse me maybe of being biased or about being unfair, or they could accuse me about a lot of things, but frankly, the fact that everything I do is from first principles. I don't start with anybody else's idea on stuff and say, that's going to be the way I'm going to evaluate that. That's what aggregators do. That's what they look at. That's not me, you know, and whatever I think about David Ojabo is based on my evaluation of David Ojabo. I can tell you that and not somebody else's. And I'll say this. I don't think it's appropriate for the Ravens, anybody in the Ravens organization, but really Harbaugh needs to be very clear of this, to point the finger at someone for doing that. Harbaugh's a great communicator with this in a number of ways. I mean, I think he's too open about the injury situation. I think he should have a no comment is our only comment policy with regard to that. That would make things much easier. And since I don't demand any of that, I'm not fishing for news items that I can tell a listening public as a reporter, because that's not really what I am. You know, I want to make my own evaluations anyway. So talk about it however you want. In fact, I'm going to also evaluate how you talk to me in the interview process, like I'm kind of doing right now.
Yeah, I mean, and I think I also think, like, you don't need a bachelor's degree from the University of Film Study Baltimore to know that David Ojabo has not been a good football player. Like I've said, I mean, I don't do nearly the same level of work that you do in terms of charting snaps and statistics and all the amazing original creative work that you do. But even without that, I can pretty confidently say that David Ojabo is not a good linebacker.
All right. Well, fair enough. Anyway, there's no question about the Ravens continuing to ride with Mike Green. I had concerns here. I was talking. One of the ones was actually lack of commitment to Mike Green. There's been no problem on that end. You know, they've seen things in Mike Green. They like what they see enough to keep riding with Mike Green. They also don't have a choice at this point. But if anything, they've increased his snap share beyond the minimum that they would have to use him at a point like this by a factor of 2.5, probably, you know, to get him more playing time. Adafa Yowe is playing well. I know everybody hates Owe right now, and he's not, you know, thought of as being a real pressure generator. I mean, it's very hard to generate pressure against Patrick Mahomes, period. He had, you know, contributions to two of them. He didn't have a whole bunch of pass rush snaps in this game. I think it was something about even in pass rush and run snaps in this game. I might be wrong about that, but it was fairly close. He had 5 tackles, 4 defensive wins. I mean, that was one of the few real standout performances on the defense there. So I thought he played the run well in this game. It's just, you know, they've got three guys right now who could play football at outside linebacker, and they desperately need a fourth. When Kyle Van Noy comes back, you're replacing David Ajabo with Kyle Van Noy. That's a big step up in the outside linebacker core. So it's one of the positions where I actually kind of feel good prospectively. Of course, if they had another injury, then we're back to having Ajabo back out there on the field.
Sure, but that group of four that you mentioned, Owe, Van Noy, Tavius Robinson, and Mike Green, you know, Van Noy and Owe are two guys who can, on pass rushing downs, when the Ravens happen to be able to get to them, flip inside on some of those packages and help out the defensive line depth there and the lack of depth there, I should say. You know, with Owe, I think the desire is for him to be a game changer by now in his fifth year, the former first round pick, the athleticism, the production that is increased but never exploded. And like kind of like you were saying with Harbaugh, all the talk from the team has raised expectations of Owe in the public sense. Now, maybe with the two of you, you and I analyzing film week in and week out, weren't expecting him to come in and have a 15 sack season. But that's the way that the team talked about him in training camp. That is the kind of the standard he set for himself. So my view on him is that he has been consistently good. He has not like flashed amazing plays much this season. And so being consistently good is solid. I think he's been consistently good for pretty much his whole career, even early on as a very good run defender, I felt early on in his career. But the idea that he is going to be a true game-changing impact edge defender is just not there. And I think that the first-round investment in him, but when that pick happened, it was viewed as a long-term play, a guy who's raw but has all the athleticism and the tools to grow into a high-impact edge rusher. And last year and this year were the times where that should have been happening. And he played very well last year, but I don't think he's had the same impact to kick off this year.
I guess I wouldn't disagree with that. I don't think he's too far off, actually, in truth. But the problem is that he had a pretty decent close rate last year, and he's 0-for so far this year in terms of having any of his pressures being converted into sacks. So that's always disappointing when that happens. And last year, his close rate was good. His close rate of quarterback hits or sacks out of his total pressures was about 50%, which is, by the way, completely unsustainable. You won't have a player who maintains that kind of level. So I thought the thing he needed to do more than anything was increase the base of his pyramid with more pressures. So no increase in the number of quarterback hits and sacks would make his pyramid normal again.
Yeah, but to that point, Ken, finishing has been the issue. Finishing has been his issue his entire career. And so
Nick, I'm telling you, last year it wasn't. He had all these sacks.
No, last year, before that, his first 3 years, right, he has some very, overperformed relative to his pressures in terms of finishes last year. This year, he is closer to what his first 3 years were in terms of finishing. And that is a problem I see on his tape is what I'm trying to get to. It is a problem I've seen on his tape relatively consistently. And so point being, last year was not to me the real Adafe Owe. What you have is a consistently good player. He is not a game changer.
All right. We got to move on and we're going to try and go a little faster on the inside linebackers, even though the inside linebacker position now is in complete chaos. I don't know where it is. And the big thing is there's an unreported injury here that I think is true, because if it's not an unreported injury, it's an unexplained benching. So it's one of those two, but we're going to talk about it in just a minute. So the inside linebackers in this game obviously had a disastrous afternoon. Roquan Smith going down with the injury. Whatever you think about Roquan, he's light years ahead of the other three guys that the Ravens can put out there in terms of Buchanan, Simpson, and Hummel. And he's a different player here. So it wasn't a good game for Roquan. He hurt himself. He was one of three players to miss Breshard Smith on that ridiculous tight roping of the right sideline, where he danced past Roquan with no space. I mean, there's no space at all there. He dances right by him. Then he dances by Teddy Buchanan. I'm not sure the order on that. Then he danced by Nate Wiggins. And then finally Hamilton comes over and pushes him out of bounds. But just a absurd play where the Ravens accumulated some missed tackles for some of their best players.
Yeah, and that was you know, missed tackles were a huge issue against the Lions, and you saw that play and you thought, here we are again. With Roquan, it was not surprising, but it was still disappointing to see him struggle against the Chiefs. Such a good game against the Browns. And yes, it was the Browns, but we've seen beating up on an inferior team help kind of kickstart guys' seasons and kind of get them back in the rhythm. And obviously Roquan struggled against the Lions, and you know, again, though, this is not a case. Fans have been saying this, and I referenced this earlier. This is not a case where a player was playing poorly, and so he gets injured, and now he's not playing anymore, and that's a good thing. That is not good thing. It is just not.
Yeah, and against, I'm gonna just point out, Roquan's game against the Browns was one of the best by any inside linebacker in Ravens history. It stands up to the best games of Ray Lewis and C.J. Mosley. I don't think anybody would you know, suspect that C.J. Mosley had a bunch of games like that. They would expect that Ray Lewis had a bunch of games like that, and he really didn't. I mean, very consistent. He had 25 tackles, I think, by the coach's count against the Giants in 1997. You know, so he's had some absurd games, but Roquan had a bunch of tackles for loss. He had he picked up the fumble and ran it in. I mean, this game was a very, very special game for him against the Browns. And that's a seriously quality interior offensive line that they create with Teller, Posick, and Bitonio. So that's, you know, guys that could give Roquan trouble in terms of climbing and making blocks. So, you know, I was very, you know, very thoughtfully impressed, I thought, about his game against the Browns. And then against the Lions, he did look quite bad. And he had a good start, by the way, in that game. And then it just looked, all of a sudden, he just could not get off a block to save his life the rest of that game.
Yeah, it's, you know, we don't need to get too much into Roquan's performance here. You know, to me, it's more about what's next, right? You have three off-ball linebackers on the roster: Teddy Buchanan, Trenton Simpson, and Jake Hummel. Obviously,
Buchanan, Jay Higgins to that list, by the way.
And Jay Higgins, yes, and that's actually a very good player to remember. You know, Buchanan obviously took over the starting job from Trenton Simpson this year. Simpson, I think, as you mentioned, was moved around outside linebacker on some snaps in this Chiefs game. And it'll be interesting to see. You know, Hummel was on the field in that game. I felt like I didn't see Buchanan towards the end of the game. It felt like that's when I started to see a lot of Hummel and Simpson as the Mike and Will.
This is the big unexplained absence, okay? Because Buchanan played 53 snaps. He kind of looked lost in coverage. He had some mediocre run defense during the game, certainly. I think Mahomes picked on him fairly regularly with four plays for 41. But he sat out the entire fourth quarter. Now, one of two things is true. Either they're upset with Buchanan's level of play, ability to shed blocks, or whatever, or they decided, hey, maybe we got to look at somebody else who might need to replace Roquan in the mic. That's possibly an error too. Or Buchanan is hurt, and we just haven't heard about it yet, but it's going to show up on the injury report on Wednesday. And by the way, saw exactly that out of Travis Jones this last week. I was one of the first people to talk about Travis Jones's injury because it was clear he left the field. He actually raised his hand. He asked out of the game late in that ball game. And it's, I mean, he's got to be hurt if that's the case. I think Buchanan, we may find out that he's hurt. He is the obvious replacement at the mic, I think. And if they don't even have him to play Mike, they are really going to be fishing to try and determine who it'll be. I still don't think it'll be Simpson. So I really think it comes down to either Hummel, a special teams linebacker going in to play Mike, which we've had before, or I think it possibly could be Higgins going in to play the mic.
Yeah, I think the way to approach a season like this is, especially as you get later into it, or early on, you're still trying to figure out, you know, how can I win games? How can I win the next game? If things keep trending this way for the Ravens, and it does start to look like the lost season that many are suspecting it to be, that's an opportunity to baptize Buchanan and Higgins and whichever other young players you want to by fire and get them ready for 2026. And so I'm all in favor of that. I think the linebacker situation in particular is a case where I would endorse giving Higgins a shot. Now, you don't have to hand him the mic and the green dot next week. We don't need to get crazy, but he's probably on the field. He should probably get some chances and just, you don't really have that many other choices anyway.
Yeah.
And so if you think about, well, Hummel's a 1 year special teams guy. Simpson has 2 years left or one more year after this year on his rookie deal and isn't trending towards being a long-term guy for this team. Jay Higgins could be an impactful player for the Ravens next year. Yeah. And so again, early on, you're still trying to do what's going to be best for the immediate win. But as the year goes on, you know, if the injuries continue, if the losses continue, Higgins should really get a shot.
Yeah, let's see what he can do. I completely agree with that. Trenton Simpson played 37 snaps, and he came back to play at the end of the game. He was in there in some oddball packages towards the beginning. Vic Buchanan was basically playing with Smith. And then he came back, and he played a little bit at the end of the game with Hummel after Buchanan left the game. And he played some with Buchanan after Smith left the game. So, you know, they were juggling and juggling very hard to try and get through this, obviously. You know, if we're talking about who do the Ravens field for the rest of the year, now let's go into the worst possible world assumption here that Roquan is out for an extended period and Buchanan is also lost for a period of games, maybe even an IR stint from this point. I don't think Simpson is the mic. I think you might go initially with Hummel as the mic. You can get yourself back to four linebackers by elevating Chandler Martin, who played extremely well during the preseason, and getting him some rotational play, but also using him on special teams the way they've been very effective using Higgins. I think they at least can get the special teams bodies they need back if they were to bring him up. But I also think it's possible they go to the street because it's not a difficult size and shape pool to fill. And all you have to do is look back at the 2019 Ravens and how they picked up both Josh Bynes and LJ Fort during the season to fill their enormous holes at inside linebacker.
Does CJ Mosley want to unretire? There was legitimate talk between him and the Ravens. There was contact between him and the Ravens this offseason. The Ravens were looking into bringing him in. He opted to retire. Who knows what it could be? I know. You know, veteran players sometimes don't want to have to go to a place where they have to battle for a spot. They either want to know they're going to play or not play at all. This would be a situation where he would know he's going to play now. That's a call I at least make. I don't know the linebackers that are available off the top of my head. I know Juwan Bentley was released by the Patriots during final roster cuts. I don't know if he's been picked up. Are there other names like Kazir White?
And you don't have to know them all, Nick, because regardless, that's your job of the Ravens personnel department. Yeah.
Regardless, there are a handful of guys you could go out and give a chance to, especially because, and this is probably a bigger conversation for another time, but we've seen the Ravens find no shortage of success going with, going cheap at inside linebacker. It raises a very salient question about their positional spending and Roquan Smith's contract and the question of, do you have a 32-year-old veteran minimum guy next to a 26-year-old guy in his rookie deal, and that's your $2.5 million starting inside linebacker duo? Is that the most efficient use of resources? Again, a bigger question for another time. More to the point, might have to go to the street. And honestly, I don't think that's the worst call. Hummel is purely a special teams guy. He is never stuck on a defense. No defensive coordinator has ever wanted to roll with him for a significant period of time. It's hard to imagine that's part of the answer either. Losing Ardarius Washington is, we talked about it at the time. I know you and I talked about it over the offseason, but it has such huge ramifications because if you were in this situation and you had Ardarius Washington, you could drop Kyle Hamilton into linebacker if you really absolutely have to, because I think he's already going to get the green dot and be relaying the defensive signals. That's what he was doing on Sunday. So he's already going to be in that role, and he could do it. He is the guy that you could point at for a half dozen roles in the defense and say, hey, we need you to do this. And he could do it. With Washington out, you would then have to trust Lowry or Kane on the back end, and the secondary is a mess. And it just doesn't seem like an option.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm with you on that. I think that Lowry would go in. I first of all, Hamilton now being a $25 million a year man, there's no way I don't think they're going to risk him as a full-time linebacker, but I do think they'd use him as a dime. And that's not only is that a not insignificant number of snaps, they're the highest leverage snaps. So that's when you really need him playing in that spot. I think he could be a big nickel the rest of the time, and that may be another place where the Ravens need him. So let's get into the cornerback situation for a moment, because this situation got a lot more complicated. Marlon Humphrey, it's been reported already he's going to miss a couple of games. Nate Wiggins, I don't know exactly what's wrong with his arm. It looked initially to me on the sideline like he was telling him, I can go right back in. It's no problem. And then you see him carted off the field, and it looks like he's in too much pain even to consider something like that. So I'm just, that kind of was a disconnect for me, and I'm trying to put the pieces together. I seriously hope there's not a serious structural problem to the elbow that is a long-term fix, but I certainly can't rule it out watching him get carted off the field.
Yeah, I just knocked on wood over here in case you heard a little knocking noise. Wiggins, one of the few bright spots in this defense to start the year, maybe the most consistent bright spot is the best way to put it. Felt like he bounced back within the Bills game. He was maybe the most consistent defender outside of Kyle Hamilton so far this year. And, Matt Ibike, obviously, I don't think that's a stretch. Knowing him and his mentality, it's not surprising that he said, screw it, I'll go press them with one arm. I don't care. I think the Ravens were like, we can't put you out there and have you get even more seriously hurt. And two, it was hard to judge, because he didn't look like in terrible spirits. He just looked like he was, hurting, but he didn't look like a player who felt like his season had just ended, at least,
right.
which is obviously the goal. With Humphrey out, that's going to bring Keon Martin into the slot, as it did on Sunday. With Wiggins out and Jair Alexander still a major, major question mark, it'll be Chidobe Awuzie and TJ Tampa starting on the outside.
Tampa at his position at left corner.
Yeah. Yes. In Wiggins' spot, yes, because the Ravens have this cornerbacks down their own sides. You have Tampa step in for Wiggins. Jair Alexander is just a big old open question now because he doesn't have an injury designation and he's practicing in full. Because if he wasn't, we'd know about it. And Harbaugh has been optimistic about his progress, but not optimistic to the point of saying anything soon. It's really hard to imagine Alexander being back next week just because of how little we've heard about his return. And I know the Ravens try to keep things a lid on their injuries at the castle. But that would be provided that he can come back and play at the level that is expected of him, maybe not even the level that's expected of him, but even at just an above average level. He doesn't have to be the Jair Alexander, but just be an above average cornerback. He doesn't need to play up to maybe what he was earlier in his career. I think that even that would just be a big boost.
Yeah, I think it's a big ask too. I think if he were to be an average corner, I think it would probably be at least as high as my expectation would be. Let's put it that way. So
I'm obviously saying his expectation in terms of his career more generally. I think, and the expectation coming into week one, I think were higher than they should have been. I think something I've noted that I may have noted with you is, you come off a big injury and you're a gambler that relies on athleticism to make up space. Mm-hmm. Well, all of a sudden you don't know how fast you're moving and you can't make up that space fast enough. And you're pushing all in on hands where you've got nothing.
Right. Well, that's fair enough. And probably pretty good analogy too. I want to talk about a couple of corners here that you mentioned briefly. Chidobe Awuzie has been a rock so far for the Ravens. And thank goodness, kind of reminds me of the season Ronald Darby had in 23, mm-hmm. a couple of years ago when he was really outstanding. Awuzie hasn't quite been that good, but he's allowed 6.3 yards per target, which is good for a corner. And he's playing well. Did allow that touchdown to Marquise Brown in this game on a play where he had to cover Marquise Brown crossing the field, which is a big mismatch in terms of speed at this point in their respective careers. Keon Martin's effort level was way higher than just about everybody on the field. I mean, he's flying around making plays. He got lost in space one time. The tackle on Noah Gray by the left sideline was a thing of beauty, I thought. But generally speaking, he's the guy I'm probably less worried about than anybody else right now playing slot corner. The only reason I'm a little bit concerned about him is because he's a very elfin, size and shape. And the chance of getting of hurt is probably a lot more on the inside for a player like him, particularly if he gets involved in run plays. That's something that ended up in this game really coming back to get Wiggins, even though, as we can both attest to, he's a lot more muscular this year than he was in 2024.
Yeah, and that's, again, exactly what we were talking about earlier in terms of how the injuries change up everything else you want to do, because all of a sudden it's hard to defend the run out of nickel if Keon Martin's in the slot. He's going to put in the effort, but how many times do you want to put him in that position to take on tight ends, God forbid a pulling guard, with that frame? He will put the effort in. And one of the concerns is a guy that puts that much effort in is potentially more liable to get injured, right? We've talked before about Kyle Hamilton, the Ravens sometimes protecting him from himself when they hold him out of practice, it being less of a concern of, you know, his injury right then, and more of a concern of he doesn't have a slow speed. He goes full the whole time. And you have a guy putting in the effort like Martin, you could have the same issue. Either way, though, it's still going to be hard to defend the run out of nickel with him there.
Right. I mean, if you look at the smallest slot corners in Ravens history, all of them were highly injury prone. Ardarius Washington, Corey Ivey, Tavon Young. Martin is a lot more like them than he is like other guys that the Ravens have had. And even if he gains some muscle, I think he's a potential injury risk. So hopefully, they get real quality value and a healthy year out of him this year. And if they do, I think he'll play well. If he ends up getting hurt, obviously, it's probably a risk they can't manage for. Humphrey, much more physically up to the demands of the position, and the Ravens need him back at some point fairly soon. What do you think about the possibility of Marlon Humphrey moving to safety at some point this season, if that were a way to get Hamilton up front?
So you'd move Humphrey to safety, you'd keep Keon Martin in the slot, and you'd put Hamilton at dime, and then...
I think the change I would advocate is Humphrey to the back end for every play, other than base defense. Base defense, it's still Hamilton. So any nickel or greater, any 5 DB or greater situation, he's on the back end. With 5 DBs, if the personnel suggests it, he plays big nickel. If it just doesn't fit for it, he still stays on the back end. And then on third down, he becomes the dime player, taking over essentially for the weak side linebacker, because the Ravens have been playing this Mickey Mouse 4-corner dime, which they've been actually a little bit not perfectly suited, I don't think, for the size responsibilities of the tackling on it.
Yeah, I mean, I think putting the general principle, the basic idea of put Kyle Hamilton in a harder position where he has to make more plays, and put Marlon Humphrey in a position where he's asked to make fewer tackles, where he is, that football IQ and ability to read plays is a little bit more helpful than purely athletically reacting to receivers in front of you. I guess I could see it. He's been taught, he's been pegged as a potential safety convert for later in his career before. I think that would require some confidence in his health more than anything else. If the idea is we want to put him back there to, so that we can get him back on the field, even if he's not 100%, that's always a really risky proposition to me.
Yeah.
Because then you go into a game, I think left tackle in this last game was a great example, is you go into a game and he gets injured and, it's the game day roster. You don't have someone who you could just call up from the practice squad to replace him right then and there. So I guess I'm always hesitant about that idea. But if he is back to a reasonable amount of health where that's not a concern, and that's the best way to optimize this defense, I'd be all for it.
Yeah, I think the reason you would do it is because he no longer has the optimal speed to play corner, and it's causing him to make bad plays. So you put him in a position where instincts are more important than speed, and he's shown some of the real ball skills, especially last year, in terms of coming off to play somebody else's man. And make an interception. That's just what you want out of, a half field safety. I think he potentially could be ideal there. And I think Marlon is at an important crossroads in his career this year. He could be a guy who's cut and for cap savings. He could be a guy who's traded. He could be a lot of things could happen with Marlon Humphrey for 2026 if he can't demonstrate that he's still able to play corner or convert to safety and demonstrate some value there.
Yeah. And I believe you and I talked about this before as well, the decision to restructure him early in this offseason, really pushing that decision point to next year, doing the same thing with Roquan, both players getting injured. It does place a lot of pressure on some of those contracts and some of the Ravens' decisions heading into next year. Again, I don't want to get too dragged down in the cap of it all, and kind of pivot back to Humphrey as a safety. I think that the advantages of that have to include better communication and cohesiveness along the back end of the defense. And obviously changing positions around like that can be a detriment to that.
Yeah. Oh, don't deny it.
Yeah. And so for that reason, I guess is the only reason why I'm hesitant is because we've seen that issue with the defense already. And then inserting Humphrey back into the, I guess I would have to see what things are looking like when Humphrey is ready to play again, which is a bit of a cop-out, but that is
it's the information you don't get, Nick. You have to make that decision before you can see whether or not he can do it. Now, you don't get, let me give a control group of 10 games and see if he can play well in that.
I don't mean that. I mean, having more clarity regarding the team's overall injury situation.
Okay, fair enough.
And when he's back, how does he look on the practice field? For example, what are some of those metrics saying? Now I don't have that information. But the other relevant information is what's going on with the rest of the secondary, what's going on with Wiggins, the linebacker position, because that's another reason why you'd want to get Hamilton down on the front lines is because you don't have Roquan. If you have Roquan, then the need to do that is a little bit less. The need to move back Marlon back to safety is a little bit less. That's what I meant about needing Fair the enough. Information, not needing to see how he would do it, obviously.
So just to finish up with the safety spot, the safety spot so far has been untouched by injury, but what the team really needs is they need to have another split field safety they can trust on the back end. That could be Humphrey if he were to move and the Ravens could afford him to move, which that just may not be realistic at all for 25, given the injuries at cornerback. But they could bring Lowry also in to play regularly. And they had him inactive again after having him active against the Lions. Also a little surprising to me is they really, I think, need to make a space for Lowry to be there so that they have the back end coverage to move Hamilton up in the slot. Even against the Lions, they only played him for one snap. So
especially with a complete unwillingness to put Sanusi Kane on defense. And which I haven't, you know, he's only played a handful of snaps, so it's hard to draw many meaningful conclusions from that. I thought he looked good, much improved this offseason relative to last year in terms of his ability to cover, right? He's always been a fine tackler, downhill player. But I've been a little bit surprised, and I maybe we'll see it more now with the injuries, that he hasn't gotten any kind of run on defense, despite kind of being unofficially named the third safety during training camp. And this is a team that has run a lot of three safety dime in the past, and to basically cut it out of their defense entirely, to me, speaks volumes about Kane, because they really must feel like they cannot trust him on the field.
Well, they played a snap of quarter on the last half of the game against, I forget if it's the Browns or the Lions actually, but they played a snap of quarter and Lowry, not Kane, was the guy on the back end. Mm-hmm. Right there. That's all you need to know as far as I'm concerned. I mean, it's only one snap, and yet it speaks volumes about how the totem pole is arranged. And obviously, if Kane is on the team as the third safety, they're willing to say, well, okay, I guess we have to live with it if he's forced into the game, but we need him for a special teams value. In Lowry's case, hey, we can only point to one snap he had on defense last week. It's not like he's the biggest asset that ever was there. It's a little bit like the Rasheen Ali over Keaton Mitchell argument to me.
It doesn't look so great when Rasheen Ali fumbles the ball and can't get out past the 20-yard line on a kickoff return. I just think that the idea that, I don't want to get into this, but the idea that the Ravens special teams units are so good that they have to have certain guys active, it just doesn't show up in real life. The punt blocking, the kick blocking units, like those are, you know, fantastic units. But the idea that they have to have Sanusi Kane and Rasheen Ali active on game days because they're such world beaters on special teams is ludicrous. I'm sorry. Those guys are fine players, but they don't contribute on the offensive or defensive side of the ball. That's two game day roster spots.
Right. And they need a safety active. And obviously, if you're saying it should be Lowry, I would basically agree. Lowry doesn't have a big special teams background to point to there. But on the other case, in the case of Ali, The big swing and a miss is that if you need Justice Hill to play some special teams, he could do that. And until this game, Justice Hill hadn't done anything offensively to ask out of special teams because he was too important to the offense.
Well, and the running game is stuck in the muck. You have teams just completely collapsing the holes in the middle of the field, the holes in the offensive line against Derrick Henry, because they're not really, you know, they don't seem to be afraid of the edges. The Ravens haven't been good at pushing the edges so far this year. That's Keaton Mitchell. That's the kind of things you can do. And I have to say, I kind of resent, and maybe resent isn't the right word. Maybe it is, Harbaugh saying that, oh, well, you can't get him back. You can't get him out on the field, as if two back pony sets aren't a thing that the Ravens have used in the past to success. Right. I know I'm getting a little louder and animated now, but these are the things that really, really get to me. You know, it's basic stuff. It's stuff that someone like me, who, again, I don't have a crazy background in this. I've taught myself almost everything I know about football, especially when it comes to roster management and all these things. And it's just so plainly obvious to me that, you know, the marginal value you get from Rasheen Ali on kickoffs is nowhere near to the boost that Keaton Mitchell could provide you on offense when there is proof of concept on him doing this. Anyway,
by the way, I don't think you get marginal value on kickoffs from Rasheen Ali over Mitchell. And I think that the offensive value you get out of Mitchell in terms of misdirection alone is enormous. And I think Harbaugh has basically said it when he says, if he comes in the game, everybody knows he's getting the ball somehow. Well, good. Make use of that, damn it.
Yeah. you have the Hill, and you don't acknowledge that with the Hill and Henry split either, though, and the way the defenses are able to use that to key. It's maddening. Again, right. I won't go on because I know we're supposed to be talking about
the defense. We gotta shut it off here anyways. If we've got an hour and 10 here, and we're gonna come back for the second part of the show and talk about a lot of individual things from this game, but I thought this was a good discussion. Nick, thanks so much for coming on. Always great pleasure talking football with you. And where can people find your work online?
Yeah, I'm excited to share. I've moved over to Baltimore Beatdown. I've taken over from Kyle Barber as the managing editor over there. So you can find constant Ravens news and analysis from me and our excellent team of writers. I can also be found talking ball on the social media app formerly known as Twitter at Nick, N-I-K, knows ball. Come chat with me, and I hope you'll agree.
Okay. Other folks out there, thanks very much for listening. As always, difficult loss. Hopefully we've helped you process some of this, and, you know, by talking about what it means to us and how we'll go through that. As always, the best thing you can do to help the pod, like and subscribe if you're watching this on YouTube. Always nice to get a few extra algorithm points, and then write a 50-word 5-star review for us on your favorite podcast platform. Again, thanks for listening. Nick, thanks again for coming on.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
Hey, it's Austin James. If you're like me, trying to live your best life while living with diabetes, you can relate to worrying if you're doing a good job managing your diabetes. I use the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor to get real-time glucose readings and see the impact of every meal and activity to make better decisions. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor can help me live life with diabetes on my own terms, and it gives me more time for the things I love, like being a dad and a musician. Now this is progress. Learn more at FreeStyleLibre.us.
For prescription only, safety info found at FreeStyleLibre.us.